The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Assalamu alaikum, this is Noor Khufan, and you are listening to this Muslim Girl podcast. This podcast was created for myself to carry dialogues of open communication for Muslim women by Muslim women about various topics, but it also serves as a resource for women to have a platform to share their narratives of their successes, their struggles, and their experiences. More now than ever, Muslim women are being underrepresented and misrepresented in our communities and in the media. It is time that we created a space where we can hold the microphone and be able to truly and genuinely speak our truth. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining me yet again. I'm really excited about sharing this episode with you. Today, I have with me Maryam Muhammad. She's a 24-year-old Somali Canadian American, and she's someone who has faced a lot of unique set of challenges growing up, from her father's deportation to her Niqabi mother being the sole provider of her family, as well as just many identity dilemmas. She says that in these challenges, it has made her a better person. The person that she is today is a young Muslim American female who is a recent college graduate trying to navigate life with an interesting life scope of experiences and understanding. So welcome, Maryam. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. So I wanted to start off with just maybe a little background about yourself, and if you can briefly describe to us what life was like, you know, before we get into the story about your father's deportation and, the nuance of what was going on. I want to know a little bit about what life was like for you and your family prior to that.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I was born, so as some of my older siblings, in Toronto, Canada. So four of us were born there, and the rest were born in San Diego, so it was two. So I'm the third oldest of six children. So that is pretty average for a Somali family, actually. From there, just to give you extra background, my family came to Canada prior to the Somali War. They weren't really refugees. They came for economical and educational opportunities. So I would consider my parents very fortunate to have missed the bullet of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. They came there. My dad was working. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. It was a very, how can I say the word, very common household. Mm-hmm. You know, although they are very conservative, practicing Muslim, you had the dad that was earning the breadwinner. The mom that was a stay-at-home mom that was basically baking pie in the evening kind of thing. So this is the household we were raised in. We moved to San Diego, which was kind of a culture shock if you think about it, because Toronto is nothing like San Diego. Mm-hmm. It is, we have all the seasons over there, no seasons here.
No snow.
A lot of the buildings are shorter. We're looking around, we're like, where are the buildings? And then someone explained to us, oh, we have earthquakes here, you know? Yeah. We don't have the opportunities to have tall buildings. But aside from that, we had regular life. I would consider us almost in the middle class range. Mm-hmm. My family was really big on education, so we had private tutors a lot of the times. We went to private elementary school. Mm-hmm. So isn't that crazy? So thinking about it now, from a retrospect standpoint, after everything happened, I can almost say we lived almost a privileged life. My dad really was trying his best for us to get the most out of the American dream. He wanted us to be in school. He wanted us to go to college. He wanted us to have a career path. Every opportunity you can think of an immigrant wants in America, mm-hmm. you name it, my dad wanted it for us. And I know that's very common in a lot of immigrant households, in any household at that. Everything was great and dandy. You had both parents there, loving parents that cared about you, that supported you in everything that you did. And their presence was so important to obviously any child. Being that I take a child development now, it's so vital for a child to have two parents in their life. Mm-hmm. In terms of their self-esteem, in terms of everything, they need both parents' presence. Like, I remember my mom and dad would just watch them and we'd be in awe because they're such a team. And they worked so beautifully together. And you can see that they were trying to build a life that was so beautiful for us children. Now, looking at it from a young adult standpoint, my mom was so, because you can tell when a child comes from a loving household, when they have certain like self-esteem and morals and like mannerism. My parents were so big on raising us right. It was so key to who we are today. So I remember we would go places with my mom and everyone would tell her, like, what do you tell your kids? Please tell us. We want to tell our kids the same thing. And it wasn't necessarily what she was telling us. It was she led her life in a way that we wanted to, by example. Like, whatever my mom and father did, it was like they were our, what is it called, role models. You know how people look at celebrities and all these kinds of things? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we looked at them. I knew I could basically do anything I needed to do because I had their support and I had their approval and their validation. As a child, I don't think I needed it from anyone or anything else.
So then, mm-hmm. fast forward.
Yeah, what fast happens? Forward.
Like, tell us, how did everything, I mean, everything mm-hmm. changed and all because of what? Mm-hmm.
So post 9/11, I would consider like the government were doing some kind of sweeps, like basically rounding up all the potential people that they perceived as terrorists. And my dad was one of the targets or victims, I would say. On the eve of New Year's of January 2004, my dad was arrested. So I will set up the setting for you as to what happened with him. I remember, actually, there's a tape of it out there. Literally, we were in the courthouse and we watched the tape of him getting arrested. My dad basically walked into a lion's den without his knowledge. January 2004, he goes to a government building to take his oath for citizenship. And when you're taking your oath, they do take a video of you taking the oath. He doesn't know anything that's going on. He's blindsided completely. And I remember the door opens and all these FBI agents literally rush through the door. And what is it called? They have their guns drawn and they're telling him, put your hands up, put your hands up, put your hands up. You're under arrest, you're under arrest. And he's like, for what, for what, for what? And that's when they apprehend him. I don't even know if they even read him his Miranda rights at this point. Wow. And he doesn't know what's going on. Nobody knows what's going on.
He was this but close of course, to receiving his citizenship.
This close. He went through every other process. Everything's like fine, everything's okay. The last step of the way when he needed to get his citizenship, he gets arrested. And it almost, you kind of think about it, like it probably was a setup this whole time. They probably didn't want him to get his citizenship since the beginning. And they just wanted him to go through the process and arrest him then and there. And it was very dehumanizing and almost humiliating how they did it. Mm-hmm. Oh, keep in mind that at the same time, how my family found out or got word about my father's arrest was my mom dropped us off at school. Some of us were in middle school at the time and some of us elementary. I think one of us, the youngest, was in preschool, actually. There's a van that was sitting outside of the car. We have a long driveway. Mm-hmm. It's black van, two big black vans. My mom doesn't know who they are, who's driving or anything. She just parks her car on the side of the house and she's walking up to the door. Then all of a sudden, another SWAT team is rushing her as well. And they have their guns drawn and they're yelling at her, you need to open the door, you need to open the door or we're going to knock it down. My mom is in like, you know when you go out of your body, that's what she said. She said she was watching herself.
She had an out-of-body experience.
Exactly. She was just watching herself. She didn't know what to do. Keep in mind that this is not just a regular handgun out there. These are fully clothed, like semi-automatic guys with like bulletproof vests. They don't have their face showing. They have those little masks over mm-hmm. them. And this is like a mother that just went to drop off her kids, just picked up some little groceries for lunch.
Was this the same
day? This is the same day. Coincidental, right? The same thing happened to my dad in the office. While
they're raiding your house.
Mm-hmm. And the same thing. I don't think they showed my mom a warrant. You don't have rights when you're considered a terrorist. Hmm. Isn't that crazy? Yeah.
Why do you think they targeted your father?
I think they targeted my father because he was the main reason why the Somali community here in San Diego got established. He was a community advocate, leader. He was super educated. And I think that was one of the main reasons why he was targeted. Keep in mind, like, if you take out the chiefs, then all the Indians will get in line, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And being that they basically made an example of my father, everyone else took note, like, oh my gosh, the government's kind of after us, which obviously in all the cases on the DOJ, the Department of Justice would say, basically the United States of America versus Omar Abdi Muhammad, that's his full name. It's kind of crazy to think about, a whole government came after you for what?
What was their reasoning behind?
So the reasoning was behind it was he had this money transfer system, which in Somali we call it hawalat. He basically sends money back home. Obviously, most of us are first generation here, and a lot of our families are in Somalia, Ethiopia, Yemen, you name it. So we have an obligation to our families back home, and we send them money. And they said somehow the business that he was partnered with, whatever, which obviously he had a partner and other people connected. It's like a big line of things. Oh, just to summarize it, the money transfer system that he had running somehow funded or had a connection funding the attacks on 9/11. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Some of the money that was laundered around and how the government tracked it, it went all the way back to the pilots that hijacked, obviously the people that hijacked the plane and basically ran it through the Twin Towers. All those allegations were just allegations or lies. None of it was true, and my father was acquitted for it later on.
How long after he was arrested and charged was he acquitted?
I think it was about a year. And we went through, basically, that's when hell started for everyone. We don't know anything about the court systems. We don't know what this is. Obviously, we were too young at the time to even help our mom.
Were you able to keep this? Was this, like, something only maybe your community knew about? Like, the San Diego area? Was this something blown up? Like,
oh, no. How was the coverage on that? Well, we had NBC, CNN, wow. You name it. NPR, yeah, KPBS, you name it. Everyone really had a lot of, there's a huge coverage of it. In terms of our communities, the Muslim community, whether it was the Somali or at large, we needed everyone to know, because we needed their support. Being that now my mom is a recent single parent, she has no job experience. She was a stay-at-home mom, and she was a part-time college student because she was getting her, I believe, AA to become a nursing student or a nurse. Mm-hmm. And then she was basically preparing that on the side, and she was basically raising us full time. And that basically shook everyone's world. And I can't think it shifted our reality, coming from a middle-class Somali family or just any family to having a single parent and basically being dirt poor. And keep in mind, they froze all my dad's assets. My mom and she couldn't get access to any of their joint accounts. She had no money for even milk that day. It was that crazy. All we had was the food in our fridge and the cash in the house and the cash we had on hand. We had to figure everything out. And obviously, since our community kind of like basically came together like in such a beautiful way and helped us find a lawyer. And they're like, don't worry about the lawyer fees. We'll help raise the money and funds. So we had a lot of fundraisers and a lot of events, basically raising awareness as to what happened to him. And so it doesn't happen again, just to be targeted like that and basically profiled. We had a lot of protests. I remember making signs for the protests, basically saying, free my father, you know? Wow. It's such a crazy reality, because you see this person as your...
How old were you?
I think at the time I was 12 or 11.
Wow, you were young.
So it was very young.
Did you fully understand what was going on?
I remember the first day going to court, and I remember my dad was being hauled into the courthouse in chains in an orange jumpsuit. And I looked to my sister and I scuffed. I said, wow, this is so stupid. This is like, I can't believe this is happening. You know, they're wasting their time, kind of thing. I just thought, oh, this is a mistake and everything's going to go back to normal. My dad's not a criminal. You know, they'll know it. You know, the judge is going to know. Oh, the jury's going to know. Little did I know, I was in for, I think about 2004 to 2006, almost 2.5 years going to court, dealing with lawyers, prosecutors, people being cross-examined, the whole nine. So evidence. Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about these 2.5 years, can you, because I know you had said that I think it, like after a year he got acquitted for those charges, but then there was something else following that that led up eventually to himself choosing to self-deport, correct?
leading up to it, I just think that the conditions that my father was being held in was pretty insane. I think that anytime you're labeled any type of terrorist or anti-America, you're going to be treated like dirt. And this was basically a lie perpetuated by the prosecution team for whatever reason. I do not know until this day. I would love to meet the prosecutor. I know his name is Steve Schultz. And I just want to ask him, why? I know everything happens for a reason, but what was in my father? Why did you go after him? And what was the interest that you had in him? Because there's a lot of community leaders, obviously. He's not just one person. I think that prison is never easy on anyone, whether you're going there just for just jail or for a long period of time. He served 2.5 years, and my dad would say that he can't compare it to anything he's ever dealt with in his life. Keeping in mind that this is a grown man, and my dad is like, when I look at him, I think of like an alpha leader, macho machismo kind of guy. Like, he's very a guy's guy. But to see him almost broken by this judicial system was a lot to handle. And my dad was like, I can't do this anymore. I can't be going back into this courthouse and be promised all these things just to be heartbroken again. Like, everyone's playing games at this point.
So if they acquitted him from those charges, mm-hmm. then what was it that... What else did they have against him, or what was it that ultimately led to...
So it went from a federal courthouse kind of thing, like federal charges, to immigration charges. And immigration charges was almost something like, if it wasn't him, if his name was Omar Abdul Muhammad, it could have been corrected over a phone call or just an office visit at your local INS office. But being that he was such a high-profile case, I think that the prosecution team really wanted to make an example out of him and were so upset that they couldn't find any further evidence or any way to pin him with something as crazy as 9/11. So I think the mistake what happened with INS was my dad, when he was first coming to Toronto, me in San Diego, he listed all his children. And I have an older half-sibling. I think he's in like his mid-30s right now. And from a previous marriage, in the paperwork he wrote, he was born in Kenya, but somehow the immigration office in Canada switched it to he was born in Toronto, Canada, like the rest of us at the time. Mm-hmm. A simple mistake like that, because my dad was coming here to San Diego to get his permanent resident or his working visa to bring us all here. So everything was fine and dandy until that mistake wasn't corrected and my dad didn't notice it. If he was a regular immigrant coming from any other country or any other background that wasn't Somali or even religiously Muslim, it would have been fine. But being that he was Muslim and he was a Somali, that was two red flags in itself. And the immigration officers, I think they gave him a plea deal. I can't go into the details of that plea deal, but he didn't take it. And at that point, my dad was like, this is just exhausting. He's like, I can't further exhaust my family or my community in terms of resources. I can't. He wanted a way out. He was like, I'm done with this. I'm going to self-deport. And I know the prosecution team wanted him to stay and fight this fight that they've already, like, checkmated him on. Mm-hmm. He wanted to checkmate them ultimately and say, you know what? You're not going to imprison me indefinitely and play with my life, you know? I'm going. I'm out. I'm going to live my life and just take me back home. And yeah, so he did. I remember visiting him the last day to the prison household, the prison place. And we walked in and my dad was saying, you know, we'll see each other again. And don't worry, everything's going to be fine. And you have your mother and your community's here and everyone's backing you guys. And everything's going to work out for the best, inshallah, God willingly.
And that was the last time you saw him? Now that you're visiting him and you have to leave the country.
Over 11 years, I haven't seen my father. I've only seen him this summer.
Oh, I didn't know that. I knew that you went to go visit him because we were hoping to record. We've been talking for months. And you told me that you were going to go travel. But I didn't know that that was the first time you had seen him.
It was the first time in 11 years. And that's the last conversation I had with him here in San Diego.
I didn't know this, Mariam. You didn't tell me.
Sorry. It was full circle, you know? I think I asked him a lot of questions as to what happened in the courthouses and just to kind of relive everything.
Especially as an older woman now, you can maybe mm-hmm. understand and you're more curious.
Understand more.
Yeah.
Obviously, we were all there in the courthouse just to support him and to show that his family was here and present. And the jury, we're all looking at the jury like, you do know he has a family here that he was a sole provider for, and that I'm his daughter, this is his son, this is his wife, and that regardless if we look different from you, we still share the same experiences in life, yeah. and we still go through the same emotions, and that we are human just like you. And isn't that kind of sad that we have to even put it that way for just the general populace of America to understand where we're coming from as Muslims?
Mm-hmm. That's very.
It's very unfortunate. Yeah, so I remember my father telling me his experiences in prison and how a lot of people would target him and attack him and how it was basically a hellhole.
Was he was mm-hmm. he facing like racial slurs or were people being racial
slurs? The correctional officers would get other people to come after him. Like, it's really crazy. Like, it could be a movie almost. And I was telling my father, like, you need to write a book. You need to write a book of what you've experienced, because this is absolutely insane. And being that he was a law-abiding citizen all his life, he has not a criminal record for anything, whether it was in Canada, back home, or America. He's not a violent felon, per se, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you're now in a room full of murderers and rapists and all these other crazy people.
It's a story. It's definitely a narrative, I think.
Why you're looking at put it on yeah. paper? So 11 years is a long time, though. Every time I think about it, I'm like, wow, I can't believe I waited this long. It's not waiting. I would have loved to see my father sooner. It's just I didn't have the funds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad that finally got to see him and things felt, you know, full circle yeah. for you. And
yeah.
I mean, I honestly can't imagine what you've been through, what your family has been yeah. through. I'm really interested in knowing or understanding a little bit more about your mother's experience, because I'm sure it was difficult on so many levels for everyone, and individually, like, it would be different for the different age ranges between you and your siblings and stuff. But for her to, one, lose her partner and, you know, the person yeah. that she was relying on providing for her and her children, like, what was her experience and how has she been able to handle it, and what's life like for her now?
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then, taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
SubhanAllah, where can I even begin? In that time frame, my mom, I can say that, to be honest, she was affected the most, because like you said, she lost her partner, and obviously her main source of support emotionally, physically, financially.
Mm-hmm.
She was all alone with 6 kids to raise. That I wouldn't wish that upon anyone. You know, you think that when you have children, you're going to have your partner there with you to raise your children with and have like this happy ever after life. That's the image that we always project into reality or into our minds. She was mourning a lot. She was mourning his loss, and she's mourning the fact that of the life that she used to have. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah.
And she lost that on a lot. And I know that I wouldn't say it still affects her to this day, but the remnants of the effect still is there.
Oh, I'm sure. Like, there's, you know, you cope and you kind of adapt and there's a new normal, but
mm-hmm.
I don't imagine that it's not something she doesn't think about every day.
Yeah, like, what could have been if he was here? Would my sons been different, or would this have been this way, or X, Y, and Z? Did I raise them right?
Being that we were so young. She's enormous. She's mm-hmm. now responsible for providing yeah. and raising you.
Yeah. And if we mess up, did she fail as a parent? In terms, you wouldn't feel that as a parent if you had another partner. Does that make sense? Obviously, you would have that feeling, but you would share it with someone else. It was kind of like that bond. Oh, did we fail? We're together in this. I'm not alone in this. We say this word in Somali. We say dahla soharate. Basically, you know, when you take a rope, like when you're doing karate, and you tie it around your waist.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it's a symbol of like, I'm going to continue, and I'm going to go further. I'm going to not give up. regardless of the circumstances, whatever it might be, whether what the situation may be, I'm going to support my children. I'm going to be their all. I'm going to do everything that I can do with God's will, you know?
Was your mom ever pressured? And I don't know if this is something that in the Somali community might happen, but I know in my community, if something like this happens, usually the woman is pressured to either, like, basically you go where your husband is, and so you pick up your life and you go with him. Was she ever pressured to follow your dad, or?
No, there was actually a worse reality. What they wanted to do, both sides of the families, my mom's side and my father's side, was split us up as six kids. You go to this aunt, you go to this uncle, you go to this aunt. And keep in mind that I have family all across the states.
And what was the point of that? What would breaking you
just apart? So she could stay here and go through. This is before his deportation. This was a conversation that was had. And I remember hearing it. And it was so something so scary. And I remember looking at my siblings like, are we going to be split up? They were saying, you know, you go through the whole trial with your husband, have the community support. But you don't want your children going through this because it's going to be something extremely traumatic and extremely crazy. Like, you want to split them up and give them the closest thing to a normal functional, okay. That's the word I'm looking for, a functional household.
Okay.
And after he gets deported, we'll see where everything stands from there, but we're going to give guardianship to these aunts and uncles. And everyone was willing to take us in, which was a very sweet and beautiful thing that they were willing to do. But at the same time, it's tragedy. Like, I won't get to see my younger sibling, or I won't get to see my older sibling, because I'm all the way somewhere in Minneapolis. And they're somewhere over there in Ohio or Toronto or X, Y, and Z. You get what I mean?
Yeah. It would have definitely, that. I think. Yeah. I mean, I get the intent behind it, and I understand that they were trying to, you know, preserve, I guess, the quality of life for you guys in this time where it was just very hectic. But for me, I'm just thinking about it, and I'm like, I think that would just, like, your family's already kind of destructed a little bit. I think it would just even add more to it. Like, even if you're going through a hard time, go through that hard time together as a family. It brings you closer, because when you get past it, which you do with everything in life, you have to get past it. At least you have each other. Because then 100. If you come back together after everything's happened, then you're still having to spend time to try to put pieces back together. You know?
100%. I completely agree with you. I always use this kind of like metaphor of what happened. We all witnessed the car crash in our life. And all of us walked away different.
Mm-hmm.
We all witnessed it, and everyone lived in their own truth. Some of us were affected in every way possible. Like, I can't really preach that we all became college educated and we lived our life and this and that. I know it took a harder toll on my brothers, being that the male figure was taken away, and now a woman. Keep in mind that I think I've told you this before. My mom wears a niqab. For the people that are listening that don't know what a niqab is, it's a certain veil that covers the face and only, like, exposes the eyes. So
she's been wearing that for how long?
I would say since she's 18, and I think my mom is well into her late 40s, maybe 50s, you know? I think she's in her 50s. So she's been wearing it all her life. And keep in mind that, do you think people are willing to hire a niqabi walking into your office with zero?
I imagine it's not been easy.
It has not been easy for her. On top of that, she has no, what is it called? At the time, she had zero work experience because she was busy raising her six kids. She had a husband she had a husband providing for her. Why did she need to work? She didn't need to work. But luckily, there's a lot of people in the community, God bless them, that gave my mom volunteer positions so they could be some sort of reference on her CVs when she later on developed one. She had to go through multiple volunteer opportunities and internships before she landed a caregiving job to people with, like, Down syndrome and that kind of sort.
And is that what she does today?
Till this day, my mom works as a caregiver for them. And it's been 11 years. She's been loyal to the company. I won't say the company's name, but she's been there. She had, what is it called, a day shift, but it kind of got hard. Because keep in mind that if you're a parent and you're expected to make breakfast, take your kids to school, we all are in multiple age groups, you know, drop them all off and then get to work. It got to a point where she couldn't handle it. So my mom was like, you know what? I'm going to stay with you guys in the day, and I'm going to start working at night. So my mom worked graveyard shift, and she still works graveyard shift for the last, say, 10 years, so.
Wow, mashallah.
I know. So, and then later on, she opened up her own business, in-home daycare, just to kind of supplement the incomes, and so she can afford everything.
That's pretty remarkable. She did what she mm-hmm. needed to do to mm-hmm. take care of you guys, and that's... Yeah. And the sacrifices that mothers make for their kids, sometimes it's...
I know. We always talk about it. And I look at my sister and I always tell her, like, in all of us kids, statistically speaking, we weren't supposed to graduate high school, mm-hmm. you know, let alone for some of us that ended up going to college, graduate college. Like one of my older sisters, she is, what is it called? She's now in Ethiopia and she opened up her own nonprofit organization. Mm-hmm. Mashallah, right? It's kind of amazing and it kind of baffles you. She's preparing her master's this fall at SOAS and she's pursuing her careers. I wanted to go into medicine. I have a younger sister that is in New York. She goes to Brooklyn College. And this kind of ties in with the fact that my mom is super conservative and she wears the niqab. And you wouldn't expect someone like her to understand her daughter wanting to go to a college out of state without any parental supervision and live her own life. But my mom, mashallah, being the amazing woman that she is, allowed her to go and allowed her to have the opportunity to become her own person. Because sometimes we live in, like, underneath the shadow of our parents, and not the shadow of our parents, but just their way of living for us. Does that kind of make sense?
No, definitely. Are you kidding? You're preaching to the mm-hmm. choir here. I think this is something a lot of children of immigrants face. It's mm-hmm. just those expectations of their parents for what their ideal, you know, lifestyle is for themselves. They want it for their children, although sometimes those aren't in line and sometimes there's not mm-hmm. communication to necessarily be like, you know, that's not what I want. And there's not an acceptance. There's not a comfortable, you know, space for that conversation to be had. But I want to actually, let's stay on this conversation a little bit because I want to talk about your mom being this really conservative, you know, niqabi mm-hmm. woman and yeah. the dynamic of your relationship and your sisters. You know, you mentioned to me before that one of your sisters does not wear the hijab, but yet, yeah. You know, how does that play out with your mom? How's their relationship? How's that understanding?
Because
I think
pretty,
you would think yeah. your mom would be really upset or maybe they wouldn't have a relationship, right?
I know. Speaking it from like a cultural standpoint, yeah. You normally people, like, if you take off your scarf in our community, you're kicked out. You revoke your membership of the Somali community. They just say, hand over the card.
Or you yeah. decide to self-ostracize and you just kick yourself out because you're like, I know they're going to do this to me, yeah. so.
Might as well do them the favor, you know? Yes. I won't even let you guys go through the trouble kind of thing.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
My mother, subhanAllah, like, being that she's such an open-minded person, being that she's conservative and she wears a niqab, I understand I'll give her those titles. But at the same time, that's my mother, and she gets it in that sense. My older sister, when we were growing up, I know 100% she struggled with the hijab. And I cannot tell you as to why, but obviously we all go through those phases. I've been through it myself. And she used to hide it sometimes. She used to not wear it sometimes at school. Then I can see that it turned into, like, you know what? I can't live a double lifestyle anymore. Mm-hmm. I need to have this conversation with my mother and let her know that I do not want to wear the hijab right now. She didn't say she's not going to wear the hijab ever, ever, ever again, you know? But I remember listening to that conversation, and I just was, like, fly on the wall, like, oh, my gosh, you're doing it. This girl's crazy. I was waiting for her to get kicked out. I was like, oh, my gosh, this girl's about to get the boot, you know? I'm about to have a room to myself.
That's funny.
But subhanAllah, I know my mom said, I raised you right. I do not understand why you wanted to take off the hijab, because it's such a beautiful thing. Like, you're covering for God, you're preserving your modesty, and so on and so forth. But she was like, I raised you right. I raised you with the right morals, the right values. I know you're a good person, and I can understand. Obviously, this time, and my mom is saying, obviously, this time, this generation that we're in. And she said, you're a young girl, inshallah, like, in the future, you'll take it up again, like, you'll start covering. But I understand why you don't want to wear it.
So did this reaction surprise I mean, I'm going to assume it surprised you because you thought she was getting the boot, but I'm sure, yeah. I could only imagine your sister had, like, a sense of relief because...
Yeah, she was like, I can't believe this. Like, my mom and niqabi is really accepting me.
It's beautiful.
For me and nothing else. And she's not basing her judgment off of anybody else. Does that make sense? She's being her own parent and not a parent for the masses. Because, you know, we always go by our reputation. And sometimes the things our parents tell us, it doesn't necessarily come from them per se. It comes from the community and how they wish... Yeah, to parent us. And like, I don't need you to parent me. I have one parent and I need my parent to speak for themselves.
Yeah.
So my mom was like, I'm your mother, I love you, and I know you're a good person, and I raised you right, you know. I hope you're not doing it. One thing she did say that kind of cracked me up was, I hope you're not doing it for a guy.
That's in there.
Yeah, she's like, let me just ask, is this for a guy? She's like, no, it's just for me.
She's like, okay, I accept it. You know, I think the way that your mom handled it is such an example as to the way that I think this conversation should be had. Well, one, I think these conversations should be had. I think the hijab in general, I feel like some people fear even saying that they've thought about or that they struggle with it, which I think, and I don't speak for most people, but for most people that I know, everyone's had some point in their life where they've struggled with it, especially here in the West.
Yeah.
Struggling with whether or not they're wearing it properly, struggling whether or not they want to wear it, struggling with just a lot of things. And I feel like to be able to, have that conversation with, you know, your mother, your father, someone in your family is really, really great. But to have that reaction, I think it's like you're definitely, one, being an example of what Islam teaches us in terms of compassion and patience and, like, being empathetic. And then, two, your sister is not going to have some type of negative reaction, because had your mom kind of gone crazy and it could have turned really aggressive and big and blown up, or your sister left, you know, you're severing those ties in a relationship between a mother and a daughter, or a mother, you know, a daughter and her family.
Yeah.
What are the implications of that? I mean, that person's more than likely going to be pushed away from deen and Islam. More than if you would just be like, you know what, I accept it. You know, I don't understand, but I accept it. This is your life. But still be that, like, you know, that mentor and that presence in your life and that example. Because then that person will, you know, inshallah, if it's written for them, they'll come back around. Yeah. And we have to remember that Islam for us as women is not just based off of our hijab. It's like a girl takes off her hijab, people immediately think like, oh, she's straying from the religion. She doesn't want to be a Muslim anymore. It's like... Yeah. You can have 100% of the beliefs and practice in ways in which in which hijabis don't, but that doesn't count because it's not something we can see. But I mean, what's really, religion is a relationship between you and God, you know, it's vertical. Yeah. It's not between you and people.
I 100% agree with you on that one. And I think hijab obviously is a choice at the end of the day. And I think I mentioned this to you before.
Prayer is a choice. Like,
yeah,
there's nothing that we are not automated robots at the time of prayer that we get up and pray. Like, we choose whether or not we want to take the time to get up to perform wudu, to pray, or we choose sometimes to not. And the hijab is no different, but people treat it differently.
We all know as Muslim women that we are supposed to wear hijab. Nobody's going against that. And it's been mentioned in the hadith and the Quran. I'm not saying anything against the doctrine. But at the same time, God gave us something different from shaitans and angels, which is will. We have the will to decide whether we're going to go right or left, or whether it may be. And I'm not saying that in an analogy to what my sister's actions were. It's just, it was her choice at the end of the day. Nobody was forcing it upon her. And it gave her a more, like, beautiful understanding of what Islam was and what a parent should be to their child. Yeah. I know if my daughter came to me saying, I want to wear it right now, I would have told her the same thing. I understand. I'm not going to be, oh, you can't live in my household. You're not listening to me. You're being a bad Muslim. How do I know that she's being a bad Muslim? How, like, who am I to make these judgments, whether I'm the parent or not, whether I'm a random person seeing this Muslim girl walk across the street without a hijab and say, her future is gone, or she loses credibility. She's not even Muslim. Like, who are you to make those judgments? That's actually really scary. If anything, people like that should be very weary of their actions.
Yeah, and you just know? Don't, like, how about we not, I guess, simplifying deen to just a piece of clothing for women, but also, like, why simplify, like, deen, which is, you know, this beautiful kind of complex thing in which it is very individual and it's different for everyone. Everyone practices it differently. They have a different relationship, a different connection. Mm-hmm. Why for all women then do you just kind of water it down to this, like, pieces of clothing that you wear, and how women are constantly judged by how little or how much they wear of even hijab? I'm not even talking about girls that don't wear the hijab. I'm talking about girls that wear it in different ways or wear different styles of clothing and stuff.
We're stratified. Isn't that crazy? If you're fully clothed and you're wearing niqab, it means, like, you're the ultimate Muslim. and it goes down from there.
Bubble or something. I don't know.
But yeah, if you're wearing the hijab as, like, a shayla, like, around your neck, you're a basic Muslim. And if you're wearing hijab as a turban, you're a hipster. You're not even there Muslim. Like, it's not even fair. You can't stratify someone's iman or deen or just their Islam on a basis of hijab. Some of us, you don't know, someone with a niqab that's fully covered might not be the greatest person in comparison to someone that's completely uncovered. Allahu alam, God knows best.
Exactly. At the end of the day, it just comes down to God can be the only judge, because everything is built off of intention, and no one knows anyone's intention but God, because that relies in our heart. I think even sometimes our own selves, we don't know exactly what our intentions are. And that's, like, a self-struggle, is figuring out, like, am I really doing this because I want to, or am I doing it because it's coming from some outside influence, or, you know what I mean? Like, the way I was conditioned, which I think is part of the beauty of deciding things, is because you are conflicted. It's not an easy process, but
can you imagine, though, living in America, how many young Muslim girls are facing this issue?
So many. And the sad thing is like, it's not talked about. They don't talk about it. If they do, it's maybe amongst themselves or with their closest friends, but even then, like, it's not a normal conversation to be having.
It
can be one day, because, you know, you're talking about really, in essence, the quality of life for someone. And, you know, a lot of people make the decision to not wear it, and they might feel like they're living a truer self because, they're not doing something that they felt like at that moment they couldn't do. But then they lose so much. They lose their family. They lose their sense of support from their community. It really places them in a hard place, and that's not fair. That's not what, as a community, that's not how our response should be.
It should never be that way. And it's very important that parents, I think it comes from the parents most, and the older generation, to understand the younger generation or their children in general, that you have to allow them to be their own person. Don't dictate your child's life. Trust in yourself as a parent that you raise your child right, that you instilled in them the necessary values and tools, and that any decision they make is not a reflection on their parenting skills, and that they shouldn't feel ashamed or bad about their child's decisions if it's outside their own.
I think as youth, we need to understand kind of what our parents are going through.
Yeah.
Just to understand, and then better help them understand where we're coming from.
And give me the, I always say to my mom, give me the opportunity for me to make the right decision.
Yeah.
Don't try to, like, grab my hand and lead me to the right direction. It doesn't mean anything anymore, because you basically picked it for me, regardless of how it is the right path for me. But it's better for me to become my own, like, autonomous, independent, own thinking person. Like, I always try to make that very clear, because especially living in America, you have to be independent. You have to know how to be your own person. You have to stand up for yourself. You're not going to look back and your mom's just going to be in the wings ready to, like, fix everything for you.
Yeah.
I think in our community, and I bet a lot of immigrant community, we have this tendency to almost, like, baby. Is that the right term?
Yeah. Micromanage.
Micromanage, helicopter, like, our children. Everything. It's everything. Like,
literally everything. Even after, it doesn't even matter if you get to the point where you have your own family, they still sometimes will have that presence, or at least I think there's, like, effects where children are traumatized and it's like their parents' voices are still in their heads. One of the things that I think is very conflicting for children of immigrants is, for example, I think our cultures, we come from a very communicative type of culture in which, you know, you do everything for your family and for those that are, you know, in your clan, and they would do anything for you. And everything that you do is not a representation of yourself. It is a representation of everyone. So you, before you do something, you think, how's this going to affect my parents? How's it going to affect my siblings? How's it going to affect my community? There's a lot of pressure, but then the Western culture is very individualistic in which, yeah, you know, you're 18, you're an adult, you make decisions for yourself, you move out, you know, so how do we bring these two worlds together and try to figure out our lives where we grow up understanding this individualistic, like, and also wanting that as well. I think we want it. I want to be independent. I want to do things for myself, but then having that contrast still in the background when it comes to from, like, you know, our upbringing and from our parents. So it's very difficult, I think.
It is a very difficult balance. And I think it's a beautiful thing to have, like, the balance of both worlds, of being individualistic and being able to think for yourself and everything at the same time. Know that your actions can affect others, and how your own decisions and your own way of living obviously is connected to obviously your family and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And honestly, like, this brings me back to the main point. Like, I think the trauma of everything happening to my dad and my mom being the breadwinner and standing up and, like, the whole patriarchal system kind of breaking apart in my household. And there's obviously this matriarch that stepped up, made my mom realize, like, you don't really, your decisions in life obviously affect you the most and everyone around you. Mm-hmm. And if you make the right decisions, it reflects outwards and in a very, like, amazing way. So that, like, trauma, that car accident, that craziness brought almost like a lot of blessings into our lives. It made us a more well-rounded people in the most twisted way. Is that a crazy thing to say?
I think it's part of fate and part of understanding
that
even the bad things happen for a reason, you know? It's really just having an understanding that at the end of the day, everything is really in God's hands. And even the worst of things that happen, you have to understand that there's a purpose for it and that there is always going to be some type of outcome. And you'll always come out of it
on top.
Yeah, it's basically leading you to where you are supposed to be.
Yeah, I think in my compassion levels for people is, I can't describe it. It's, I can't understand, because compassion really means, like, you can understand someone else's suffering. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. So a few years back, I used to be a college advisor, and I remember working in this inner city high school. Like, it was close to the one I graduated with. So it's kind of like full circle for me to give back. And I remember all these kids going through all these crazy things. And they're similar to mine. Some kids' parents were facing deportation for immigration reasons as well. And they didn't know what to do. And I would have some kind of insight for them and comfort and saying, like, it's okay. There. Yeah, I've been there. Isn't that kind of crazy? And I don't really share these kind of, like, private, like, details of my, like, life. And a lot of people don't know that my family had been through these kinds of things, because it's been such a long time. It has happened such a long time ago. And I remember, like, explaining to the student, like, you're going to be okay. I know it's hard for you guys to understand right now, and you feel like your world's ending, but it's okay. Your mom, like, just like my mom, she didn't know that she had that strength in her. And I know that my mom didn't have that strength in her. She didn't. And then all of a sudden, all these crazy things happen. And then all of a sudden, you find some kind of strength in you to step up and handle it.
And it's a beautiful thing that you've been able to provide that type of support for those people. And you said that you don't really share this, you know, these private matters with people, especially because it's been so long. And I'm sure it's not something that's regularly brought up. But I guess to close off, why did you want to share it now? Or, like, why did you want to put this, share your story, share your family's story? And what do you hope that people listening can gain from
it? You know, I'm a recent college graduate, and it was all due to my mom's sacrifices. And in terms of the unique life experiences that I have and the situations that I've been to, I'm not supposed to be here, but I am here, and I'm still figuring it out. And I'm still trying to find my way in this world as a young Muslim American Canadian. And even through tragedy and craziness, subhanAllah, like, everything works out. Everything is in a divine, like, web, and that you might go through these, like, routes in life, and it might take you off your road, but you always come back, and that you're always going to do what you're supposed to do here. And I know this is the side of me that's, like, the Muslimah that's speaking, but I'm a very big believer in that. And I really am sharing this experience because I know there's a Muslim family or an immigrant family or just any American family out there that are listening that might be facing, like, one parent's arrested or something, or they're coming from a single parent household, or they might be struggling somehow. I just mean to say, to give some positivity. SubhanAllah, like, if I replay it, because every time I speak of these things, it's kind of like I'm reliving it, you know? And you're sitting there like, oh my gosh, like I kind of baffle myself because it's so shocking. Like, wow, I really was in that courthouse. Wow. You know, sometimes certain traumas become a dreamlike. I can't say we all fully gotten over it. I think everyone kind of got hit with some kind of like shell shock from it. But we're all dealing with it. We're all managing and we're all trying to be like a part of society and we're trying to make a better world. I know that for my sister. I know that for my brothers. I know everyone that has been through what we've been through in our household and is just trying to make it, basically, you know, and try to get to relatability of the greater audience that might be listening. You know, as a Muslim, obviously, I'm going to be discriminated against and profiled, and I might face Islamophobia, xenophobia, but alhamdulillah, I've been through so much in my life that I know how to handle. I know how to deal. I know.
It's made you someone with thicker skin and just a stronger, confident person.
Exactly. I've seen so much tragedy in my life that, to some sense, I'm always expecting it. So when goodness comes, I'm like, I'm a little weary. I'm like,
you're cynical.
I'm like, what is this happiness? What are you talking about? When are you going to leave me? I need tragedy to come back.
It's like almost a comfort, right? Knowing, being in that place of tragedy, it's kind of like, I'm used to this. I know how to deal with this. So when something good comes, you're almost like, what am I supposed to do with this? I want to really, truly thank you for opening up and sharing this and obviously taking the time. But I believe that when we share our stories, when we open our lives up just a little bit, I know in our cultures, it's very taboo to talk about our flaws and the issues that we face, especially as families. But I think it's so powerful when you can share your story, because there is someone out there listening. And even if it's just one person that can listen and relate, or you've helped or comforted them, that is it's completely worth it. And that's why I wanted to start this. And that's why I continue wanting to do it. Even if it's hard, sometimes it's like you're helping one person, you're helping 10 people. Like, that's powerful. It's a beautiful thing. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I feel like I've gained a new friend over the months of us talking. And we're only like 4 hours away, so we definitely have to.
I know. We'll definitely have to come to San Diego.
I'll have to come to you. I mean, I would say you come to me, but there's nothing much going on in the Central Valley, so I don't think you need to come here. But I'll definitely come to you. You can, I don't know, find me some vegan restaurants I can eat at.
I most definitely have a list for you, inshallah. But this has been really therapeutic, like, going through everything, you obviously relive it, but you kind of realize, like, subhanAllah, like, I've come so far. No personal statement, no personal testimony can ever do justice to what anyone really goes through, but just being able to really share it and, like, and I get, like, feedback from it, and just understanding and love and compassion is just, like, an amazing thing. I'm just always, like, I know everyone has a unique story, like you said. Everyone has a story, and it's amazing when you have a platform to share it, because someone might hear it and might relate to it, or might get, like, guidance from it.
Definitely, and I'm so glad that it's been a positive experience for you. If it wasn't, I think I'd be worried, but positive experience, alhamdulillah, and again, thank you.
Inshallah, thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening in, and I hope you enjoyed this episode. Don't forget to like and follow This Muslim Girl podcast on all social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Also, check out the blog thismuslimgirl.com, where you can find all content information from this and all previous episodes.